Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1873 with a release date of July 5th, 2013 follows in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Ham radio responds to disasters in India and the Philippines. An emergency communications drill in Los Angeles assumes that the wired infrastructure has broken down. Spectrum changes coming to the USA, the UK, and Australia. A new sun-watching satellite will aid in propagation forecasting. And a Canadian teen creates the world's first human heat-powered flashlight. Find out how she did it on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1873 coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, reporting, here is Don Wilbanks, AE5DW.
Hams in India have again responded as flooding hits that nation. Jeremy Boot, G4NJH.
Recent severe flooding in northern India has resulted in communication links being affected when they are most needed. Members of the Indian National Institute of Amateur Radio, Hyderabad, have been providing emergency communication facilities in the worst affected areas of Uttarakhand State, North India. Reported operating frequencies include 7.073 megs, 14.160 megahertz, and call signs in use include VU2JOS, VU2MCW, VU3NUG. As usual, all amateurs are urged to give priority to emergency communications, regardless of any other activities on the band. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jeremy Boot, G4NJH, in Nottingham, in the United Kingdom.
More on the situation as information becomes available. Hams in the Philippines were ready when yet another tropical storm came their way. Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, is in the newsroom with what we know so far.
The Philippine Amateur Radio Association activated its emergency net last week, this in anticipation of Tropical Storm Goryeo. At the time, the typhoon was crossing the eastern Visayas region in the general direction of the Bicol area, located at the southernmost tip of Luzon Island. The Philippine Amateur Radio Association spokesman is Ramon Akian, DU1-UGZ. He is quoted as saying that members of the HAM Emergency Radio Operations, or HERO group, were using 7.095 megahertz as an emergency calling frequency. As such, the National Society was requesting neighboring ham radio operators to assist by staying clear of that frequency until the emergency net was closed down. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, in Los Angeles. Don?
The latest information on this severe weather event is online at the Philippine Amateur Radio Association website. You'll find that in cyberspace at www.para.org.ph. An interesting emergency communications drill on the United States West Coast as members of California's Los Angeles County Disaster Communications Service met at its Temple Station on June 24th to practice sending data, but also doing so without the use of the Internet and without the use of any infrastructure. Deputy Hector Figueroa, KE6VRL, is the Temple Station System Administrator for Communications. He says that communications was accomplished via the use of the amateur radio service and the narrowband emergency messaging software. The software is capable of running on various computing platforms and operating systems, making it easy to implement, especially in a disaster. Figueroa says that most of the Disaster Communications Service volunteers were able to install and use the system in less than an hour's time. Most used battery power for their computers and battery-powered radios to send the messages during training. These consisted of message types used in the National Incident Command System to request support, report damage, and provide health and welfare traffic. Members of the City of Rosemead staff also participated in the demonstration and training, while volunteers from San Dimas, Temple City, and Pasadena were on hand to practice and gain valuable experience. You can find more online at temple.lasd.org. The FCC has adopted a report and order that will increase the nation's supply of spectrum for flexible use services, including mobile broadband. This by opening 10 megahertz of spectrum in the bands 1915 to 1920 megahertz and 1995 to 2000 megahertz, also known as the H block, for commercial licensing. According to its June 27th report and order on WT docket 12-357, the FCC says that by enabling 10 megahertz of spectrum to be used for mobile broadband, the Commission's efforts to ensure that the nation's wireless networks have the capacity, speed, and ubiquity to keep pace with consumers' expectations and ever-rising demand for mobile services. The FCC also calls it a step towards meeting its obligation under the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act of 2012 to license 65 megahertz, including the 10 megahertz in the H block, this by February of 2015. British telecommunications regulator Ofcom has published a statement setting out its decision to release the 870 to 876 and 915 to 921 megahertz spectrum bands on a license-exempt basis. The released spectrum will be used by short-range devices and radio frequency identification. A further rulemaking procedure on the technical details of the license exemption will follow this fall. Meantime, the adoption of 915 to 921 megahertz by the Pan-European CEPT agreement is said to be possible. If it were to happen, it would create the only license-exempt spectrum between 41 and 2400 megahertz that's available worldwide. Other license-exempt frequency bands for short-range devices and radio frequency identification are only available on a regional or nationwide basis. The second attempt by Australian authorities to sell some prime spectrum in the 700 MHz band for use in expanding broadband is meeting with opposition from those who say it's needed for public safety communications. Graham Kemp, VK4BB of the WIA News.
The federal government is resisting calls to reserve highly sought-after mobile phone spectrum for use by police and emergency services. In fact, they've released a proposal suggesting it hopes to pull in more than $900 million from the sale of spectrum it could not sell earlier this year. The Office of Victoria's Premier has accused Federal Labor of effectively selling community safety to fix an ailing budget, while the Police Federation of Australia renewed calls for the government to earmark the spectrum in case it is needed by law enforcement during terrorist strikes and national disasters. Previous Communications Minister Stephen Conroy issued draft directions for the Australian Communications and Media Authority to decide by September 1 on the appropriate procedures for allocating the unsold spectrum, and said access charges would have to be at the same reserve price they fail to attract bidders during the first auction. A 30 megahertz block of the most sought-after 700 meg band of the spectrum, the waterfront property of the cell phone industry, was unsold, and the government last month said the intention was it would be returned to the market for sale at a later date.
The Australian government feels confident that it can attract bidders, but based on the last attempt to divest itself of this spectrum, it could turn out to be a hard sell. The Independent Communications Authority of South Africa has informed the South African Radio League that it has now analyzed all payments for that nation's amateur service licenses. It says that in 2012, some 209 radio amateurs paid the proper fee for a five-year license, but failed to notify the regulatory service of that fact when payment was made. This year, there were an additional 34. To rectify the situation, the regulatory agency says that it plans on mailing five-year licenses to these hams, which will be valid until 2017 and 2018, respectively. On a more negative note, the ICASA says that the same inquiry revealed that 823 South African radio amateurs did not renew their licenses, and as such, these licenses will be cancelled, and the regulatory agency says it will make arrangements for the urgent sealing or confiscation of the equipment if payment is not made immediately. The South African Radio League is urging hams in that nation to check their payment records to make certain that they have renewed their licenses. If not, they should do so without further delay. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the K9OQO repeater serving Appleton, Wisconsin. The FCC has issued a $30,000 notice of apparent liability to Remmel Incorporated and its corporate parent, Thermo Fisher Scientific Incorporated, for alleged unlawful operation of radio frequency devices on a general mobile radio service frequency for more than 9 years without commission authority. Amateur Radio Newsline's Jeff Clark, K8JAC.
On June 21, 2012, Thermo Fisher filed an application for a new public land mobile radio service license with the Commission's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. A few weeks later, July 2, 2012, Thermo Fisher filed a request for a special temporary authority to permit the operation of certain handheld radio transmitting equipment pending the grant of its public land mobile radio service. In its STA request, Thermo Fisher indicated that its handheld radios were used in connection with manufacturing certain products used by the Centers for Disease Control and other healthcare facilities. It also stated that the radios were, quote, an essential communications link for its factory operations and for the safety and security of its personnel. At the time, Thermo Fisher further indicated that it had operated the handheld radio transmitters for a number of years and that it had discontinued their operation on June 14, 2012, as soon as it became aware that the radios were not properly licensed. The STA was granted on July 9, 2012, under the call sign WQPN 622. Thermo Fisher's application for a new public land mobile radio service license was granted on August 30, 2012, under the call sign WQPW523. Because it appeared that Thermo Fisher had operated its handheld radio transmitting equipment without authorization, the Wireless Bureau referred the matter to the Enforcement Bureau for investigation and possible enforcement action. On January 30, 2013, the Enforcement Bureau's Spectrum Enforcement Division issued a letter of inquiry to Thermo Fisher, directing the company to submit a response to a series of questions relating to the unauthorized operation of the radio transmitting equipment. Thermo Fisher responded on February 27, 2013, and indicated that Rebel began operating the radio transmitting equipment in approximately October 2002. Now, in issuing the $30,000 NAL, the FCC notes that the companies admit that they operated their radio transmitting equipment without commission authorization since approximately October 2002 and continued for more than 9 years. As such, the commission finds that the companies apparently violated Section 301 of the Communications Act and Sections 1.903A and 95.3 of the agency's rules by failing to obtain commission authority to operate their radio transmitting equipment. Therefore, based on the information before it, the agency says that a $30,000 fine is warranted in this case. I'm Jeff Clark, K8JAC.
Remmel Incorporated and Thermo Fisher Scientific were given the customary 30 days to pay the proposed fine or to file an appeal. The owner of an unlicensed radio station in Marion County, Florida, and an employee were taken into custody Tuesday, June 25th, by federal authorities and Ocala, Florida sheriff's deputies, this following a tip about the illegal operation filed by a radio engineer from a local broadcast station. In early April, the Federal Communications Commission received information that a radio station on 97.7 FM was operating without a license. FCC agents came to the area and T-hunted the station to a location in the city of Summerfield. They went to the property where they saw a double-wide mobile home and a single-wide mobile home with a radio tower behind it. The station was playing Mexican music and advertising Hispanic businesses in the area. No one was home, so the agents left a warning notice and departed. However, the Property Crimes Unit of the Marion County Sheriff's Office began listening to the radio station. They also observed people entering and leaving the property. Authorities requested a search warrant, which was granted Tuesday, June 25th, leading to a raid on the unlicensed broadcast facility. At that time, Luis Alfredo Galindo and Juan Ramon Nieves were arrested and taken to a sheriff's office substation for an interview. Nieves said he was the owner of the station, for which he did not have a license, but which he admitted had been in existence for about a year. He was charged under a Florida statute with operating an unlicensed radio station and was taken to the Marion County Jail. He's since been released on $5,000 bond. Galindo claimed to be employed by Nieves. He was charged with making unauthorized radio transmissions and interfering with a radio station. He was remanded to jail in lieu of $5,000 bail, and at airtime it's not known if he's still in custody. While it may seem hard to believe, two of the nation's top communications industries are acting like hams did some 40 years ago. This in relation to the use of spectrum when rules get changed to permit broadband more access to the airwaves. Amateur Radio Newsline's Skeeter Nash, N5ASH, takes a look as history seems ready to repeat itself, but this time with billions of dollars at stake.
Shades of 2-meter frequency coordination infighting some 4 decades ago. This as the National Association of Broadcasters has told the FCC that it cannot reasonably employ a variable band plan for the post-incentive auction 600 MHz band. That is, if it includes broadcasters and wireless carriers on co-channels and adjacent channels in neighboring markets. Soon after the FCC released its post-auction plan, which intermixes broadcast and wireless operators, broadcasters and some major wireless carriers teamed up to oppose it. Both said that it would cause mutual interference or reduce the amount of usable spectrum the FCC could recover. But the FCC counters by stating that this concept is the only one that will allow it flexibility to recover varying amounts of band space in different markets. And in another shade of ham radio's band plan fighting of the past, the National Association of Broadcasters countered with its own so-called down from 51 reversed plan. This is kind of like the 2-meter inverted tertiary splits adopted decades ago by Southern California and a few other places that reverses the inter-system uplink and downlink, but on a much broader basis. I'm Skeeter Nash, N5ASH.
The FCC is seeking comments on its original plan and others, including the National Association of Broadcasters' down from 51 reversed plan, but nobody's really happy with any form of sharing. In its recent comments, the NAB said that none of the other plans adequately address the interference issue, but that the lesser of the evils would be the down from 51 reversed plan. Kind of reminds you of the past a little, doesn't it? There will be no MCOM West ham radio convention in 2013, so says the board of directors in a front page posting to the event's website. According to the Post, the board has been discussing the options for and fate of MCOM West 2013. It says there have been many changes in the volunteer workforce in the past 12 months. This, coupled with the small period of time between now and the traditional date of the event, has led the board to decide to forego 2013. The board says circumstances leading to this decision include the loss of several key volunteers, the continued inability to draw the major vendors and manufacturers to the show, and the fact that little has been accomplished to make measurable progress towards event production for this year. It goes on to say that if there is to be an MCOM West in 2014, it may require a local club to take the helm and provide the much-needed volunteer base for the event. MCOM West began in 1999 when a group of Northern Nevada amateur radio operators interested in improving emergency communications hosted the very first symposium that led to the convention as it is today. You can find more online at mcomwest.org. Ron Moorfield, W8ILC, who just returned from this year's European Ham Radio Convention in Friedrichshafen, Germany, estimates that around 14,000 or so hams attended this year's offering. Moorfield was there with a contingent representing the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, which, of course, sponsors the annual Dayton Hamvention. While at Ham Radio, the Dayton Group live-streamed the three-day event back to the United States, and it also recorded it for anyone to watch at a later date. The files have now been posted, and you can see this year's European Amateur Radio highlight at www.ustream.tv/recorded/35112685. But one suggestion, if you plan to watch all the video at once that the folks from Dayton sent back, you might want to make a big bowl of popcorn and have some cold drinks handy, because there's a lot there to see. Ham Radio 2013 was held June 28th to the 30th at the convention facility near the picturesque shores of Lake Constance in southern Germany, not far from the borders with Switzerland and Austria. And speaking of Europe's ham radio exposition, you can find out more about its inner workings in a new video produced by Gary Pierce, KN4AQ. In a one-on-two interview with show planner Petra Rothgerber, who runs ham radio, and Kelly Hall, K1LLY, the Dayton Hamvention's co-chair of international relations, you can find out how the two conventions differ in their planning and execution. It should be noted that Petra Rothgerber is not a radio amateur. By profession, she runs trade shows. And as such, she explains the way in which ham radio is a professionally managed event. By contrast, Dayton Hamvention is an event that's run by a dedicated corps of volunteers. So listening to the two talk and compare notes is an interesting experience, to say the least. KN4AQ has titled this show Europe's Biggest Ham Fest. It's episode 84 of his Ham Radio Now series, and you can find that online at arvideonews.com/HRN. And lest we forget, this week's Rain Report will feature an interview with 2013 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year, Padraig Lissandru, KC9U, US, conducted by reporter Mark Abramovich in T3V. It's all online right now at www.therainreport.com. We hope that you'll listen in. This is Ham Radio News for today's radio amateur from the United States of America. We are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. If you're interested in adventure, this is for you. The 2013 Australian Bogong High Plains Winter Trip will take place August 5th to the 9th. Amateur Radio Newsline's Stefan Kenford, NAWB, has the cool details.
Yes, that's right. We said winter, because in the Southern Hemisphere, it is their winter season as a team of radio amateurs and their friends will be heading out across the snowy wilderness to ski through some of Australia's most stunning alpine landscapes. The group will be led by VK3GT, VK3FMAW, and VK3SN, and will venture up onto mountain plateaus which sit well over 1,800 meters above sea level. Using ultralight solar-powered gear, these backcountry skiers will be active on 40 meters each afternoon and 80 meters every evening their local time. Other high-frequency bands will be activated according to conditions. And if you happen to live in Australia, contacts will also be available over the northeastern Victoria State 2-meter and 70-centimeter repeaters each day as well. So if you want to hear and possibly contact this down-under trekking adventure, keep an ear on 40 and 80 meters for a signal that will likely be just above the noise. Who knows? Maybe you will be one of the lucky ones to make contact. Crikey. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Stefan Kinford, NAWB, in rather warm Wadsworth, Ohio.
More about this Australian winter ham radio adventure is online at www.vk3sn.net. Friday, June 5th marked the 50th anniversary of a radio station whose sole purpose is to keep the nation on time. Of course, we're talking about WWVB, the sister station of WWV that sends out a time-precise signal every night that many clocks and wristwatches across the U.S. use to make sure they have the correct time. WWVB went on the air July 5th, 1963. It broadcast with 7 kilowatts of effective radiated power on a frequency of precisely 60 kilohertz. Since then, it's become the standard relied upon for accuracy and automated timekeeping. Now, an interesting article on the station's half-century of service, along with a possible projection of its future, has been written by author Joe Hansen for the online publication Wired. You'll find that at tinyurl.com/wwvb-history. Turning to space-related news, word that NASA has launched a satellite on a 2-year mission to explore a little-studied region of the sun. The new bird will help to better understand and forecast space weather that can disrupt communication systems on Earth. Amateur Radio Newsline's Heather Emby, KB3TZD.
Unlike a traditional liftoff, the IRIS sun-observing satellite rode into Earth orbit late Thursday, June 27th, on board an Orbital Sciences Corporation Pegasus rocket. This is a booster that is released from a modified Lockheed L-1011 jet aircraft that carries it to a launch altitude. In this case, the launch carrier took off around sunset from the Vandenberg Air Force Base on California's Central Coast. At an altitude of 39,000 feet, it released the Pegasus booster, which ignited its engines for the 13-minute climb to space. Shortly thereafter, NASA confirmed that IRIS had successfully reached its intended orbit and that it had received confirmation that the satellite deployed its solar panels and was generating power. The 7-foot-long IRIS, weighing 400 pounds, carries an ultraviolet telescope that can take high-resolution images every few seconds. Unlike NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory, which observes the entire sun, IRIS will focus on a little explored region that lies between the surface and the corona. That's the glowing white ring that's visible during eclipses. IRIS is being managed by the space agency's Goddard Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Its ultimate goal is to learn more about how this region of the sun drives solar wind and to better predict how space weather can cause disruptions to communications here on Earth. The latter is something very near and dear to ham radio operators worldwide. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Heather Emby, KB3TZD in Berwick, Pennsylvania.
As a historical note, the first successful Pegasus launch occurred April 5, 1990, with NASA test pilot and former astronaut Gordon Fullerton in command of the carrier aircraft. Video coverage of the June 27th IRIS launch is online at tinyurl.com/iris-watches-sun. The 2013 AMSAT UK International Space Colloquium will be held late Friday, July 19th through Sunday, July 21st at the Holiday Inn in Guildford, England. It's anticipated that both the FunCube 1 and FunCube 2 missions will be launched later this year. As such, the FunCube team will be on hand to talk about the missions and its planned educational outreach. A demonstration of the engineering model, which has been performing flawlessly for almost a year, will also be provided. The Space Colloquium will be preceded by a hands-on CubeSat workshop. This free workshop will take place at the nearby University of Surrey earlier in the day, Friday, July 19th. Further details on both events and hotel booking information is on the web at tinyurl.com/amsat-uk-2013. In radio sport news, some new rules are coming to the CQ Worldwide VHF contest. In order to be considered for an award, your log must be received by the robot or postmarked no later than 2359 UTC, August 4th. Logs received after that date will still be listed in the results but will not be eligible for award status. The 2013 CQ Worldwide VHF contest starts at 1800 UTC on Saturday, July 20th and concludes at 2100 UTC, Sunday, July 21st. Extensions may be granted by the director for a valid reason if you contact that person before the deadline. A detailed set of rules can be found beginning on page 56 of the June 2013 issue of CQ Magazine. NDX EA5RM will be active from Bolivia until July 19th as CP1XRM. What makes this operation unique is that he'll be on the high-frequency band using a 100-watt solar-powered station to a vertical antenna. You can QSL via his home call. WU2D will be on the air from San Felix Island July 8th to the 13th, signing CE0X/WU2D. He'll be active on 20, 17, and 15 meters, mainly using SSB. CE0X is the call issued to the Southern Cross DX group, but no other information is available as we go to air. G3SWH will be active stroke 6Y5 from Jamaica through July 9th. Listen out for him on all of the high-frequency bands, and if you make contact, QSL via his home call. RK4FF will be operational as 6V7S from Senegal through July 16th. His activity will be on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters using CW, SSB, and RTTY, QSL via his home call. F5SWB as TU5DF will be on the air from the Ivory Coast until October. His operations are 40 through 6 meters using mainly CW with some SSB and PSK31, QSL to his home call. PG5M will be active from Yap Island September 8th through the 15th as V6G. He'll be operational on 40 through 10 meters using CW only, QSL via PG5M. And lastly, while it may be the start of summer in the northern latitudes, it's always a good time for Christmas. In this case, we're talking about Christmas Island, where VK3DAC is active as VK9DAC. His operation is reported to be holiday style on 80 to 10 meters using SSB only, QSL as directed on the air. And finally this week, the story of how a 15-year-old Canadian student used her knowledge of electronics to develop an innovative flashlight, one that could eventually revolutionize portable lighting because all it needs for power is its owner's body heat. Amateur Radio Newsline's Cheryl Lass at K9BIK has the rest of the story.
The UK Daily Mail newspaper says Anne Makosinski is a high school junior in Victoria, BC, Canada. In deciding on a science project, she realized that Peltier tiles, which produce electricity when one side is heated and the other is cooled, could use body heat to create energy for a flashlight. So she set off to do just that. The result is a LED flashlight that lights simply by holding it on the outside. That causes the tiles to heat up on one side, while the ambient air cool down the tile on the inside. The power created by the tiles was enough, so she created a four-component voltage multiplying circuit that would provide the level she required. As a result of her efforts, this September, Anne will be one of 15 finalists presenting their projects at the Google Science Fair in Mountain View, California. The winner gets a prize of $50,000 and a trip to the Galapagos Islands. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Cheryl Essek, K9VIK, Zion, Illinois.
You can read the full story and watch the video of Anne Makosinski explaining and demonstrating her invention on the web at tinyurl.com/heat-power-light. An interview with Anne Makosinski conducted by writer Alexander Barron on how she actually developed her amazing human-powered flashlight can be read at www.digitaljournal.com/article/353536. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the Southgate News, Twit TV, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, located at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF at the editor's desk, I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW in South Mississippi, saying 73, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2013. All rights are reserved.